So this evening is devoted to a quality in the early Buddhist system named samadhi. The word often is translated as concentration. It could also be translated as integration or the bringing together of the, and then you could say of what, maybe mind or heart. They're the same word in Pali and Sanskrit in the early system. And it's a tremendously important quality that shows up in the center of the Buddhist path. Really, it's one of the core frameworks of what we might cultivate, what we must cultivate, if we are aiming for liberation as described by the early system. And the word gets then used in many different ways in many different traditions. So I'll speak primarily from a Theravada or early Buddhist framework. It's used somewhat differently, say, in Zen and Tibetan systems. So, but in all of them, it speaks to this amazing, sometimes feels quite amazing, ability that that humans have, and maybe other beings as well, but I'll speak to humans, since most of you look like humans. I was for a very short period ordained a monk in Burma in order to do a long retreat there, and one of the questions you have to answer when you get ordained is whether you're human or not. Because in the early, in the old stories, there are stories of nagas or snake spirits who are shapeshifters, disguising them as humans in order to infiltrate the Sangha and receive teachings. But you can always discover who's a naga, a snake spirit, because when they go to sleep, they revert to their original form. And so they saw this big serpent tail hanging out of a monk's hut one night, and they you know, brought that monk to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, like, naga, show your form. And, you know, you can't be a monk, you're a nine. So I'll speak primarily to humans in this talk about samadhi. The talk is in this moment at IMSB part of a series that you've been working your way through. This is the sixth of seven talks in a series, orienting around what are called the seven factors of awakening or enlightenment. The Pali word is bojjhanga. And these factors that begin with the cardinal quality of mindfulness, which we can understand as the ability of the mind to connect with intentionally an experience. And it's connected with the quality of memory. When you're remembering something, you're connecting with an experience. And so, you know, mindfulness as one of the limbs, or as one of the factors here, says we have this ability to pay attention, to connect with the experience of the body sitting, or the experience of the breath moving, or other subtle experiences, with the experience of hearing or seeing, the many senses, and many other things. We can connect with the experience of, you know, the knowledge that the body will die. Very traditional kind of mindfulness is to remember birth and death. Oh, this body will die. And, you know, to be mindful that there are these qualities of pleasant and unpleasant. Oh, I like some things and I don't like some things. The mindfulness teachings say, notice that. And then there's things to do about that. But first, notice it. So mindfulness is the first of these seven factors. Mindfulness unfolds into all the things that one must train in noticing in order to find liberation. And it's essentially a way of saying, these are the things you must see in order to understand. Understand your own mind, understand your body, understand how activities lead to results, understand the states of your mind that are some wholesome, like gratitude and kindness and generosity and forgiveness and focus and spaciousness and calm and energy, and understand the states of your mind that are unwholesome or difficult on the path to liberation, or must be dealt with, or must be healed, to use a word from a different tradition. And we call these sometimes the hindrances or the defilements, you know, the states of restlessness and doubt and dullness and wanting in a painful way, and fearing or pushing away, or anger, confusion. So with mindfulness as the first of these great factors and in some ways to be cultivated all the time in every activity, know what's happening. The factors go on into two sets of three, one of which are a set of three qualities that are arousing or enlivening, investigation of experience, really attending to our experience, not just aware, but actually investigating, looking into, chewing on, understanding, investigating with the intent to understand experience. And then energy itself, which is so needed on the path because it's hard, right? So energy, like you have to have some energy to apply to this to this process. And the uplifting qualities, you know, of joy and rapture that come, the blisses that can come, all of these qualities that are energizing, and then three qualities that are tranquilizing or calming, and the first of them is calm itself, tranquility. And so, you know, it's the order of them is as if to say, first start noticing things. Then get interested, corral your energy, and start to really feel uplifted by what you're doing. And another way to say this is turn toward the pleasurable first. First, get some energy and some engagement going. You know, and then, as you've gathered your faculties and things start to have some juice to them, then really start to calm, really start to settle, let things go. Let the mind stream and the body stream become quite tranquil. And embedded in that word quite is, that's a low-key way of saying this tradition encourages an extraordinary amount of tranquility. It actually promises that it's possible to become so calm that the mind becomes like the surface of a pond where there's no disturbance whatsoever from inside or outside, mirror-like, shining. It says, luminous is this mind when calmed. So the first of the settling factors, of course, is calm itself, and then comes concentration or samadhi. And the last of them is equanimity. And my dear friend and colleague, Oren Sofer, will come next week, I think, to talk with you about equanimity. It's a gorgeous quality. Come and listen to him. So tonight, this quality of samadhi or concentration, and that it arises when, I say arises in a kind of non-volitional or impersonal way, because you can't so much do it. If you hadn't noticed, I know you're trying to concentrate up there. You can't actually concentrate. So that may be a relief for those of you who feel like you've failed at concentrating all this time. You have failed because it's not a thing you can do. It's a thing that happens when conditions are ripe. And so what you do actually is you set up conditions. And the conditions for samadhi then is part of what I want to talk about. So here's this quality of mind that, and I'll keep using the word mind. You can keep remembering that mind and heart are interchangeable. And that doesn't mean thoughts and feelings. It actually just means that the whole realm of non-physical experience that I consider to be kind of within my field. So some of that I call, now I'm sad, now I'm angry, now I'm overjoyed, now I'm confused. And some of that I call analyze, judge, celebrate, think about. But they're not that different, really. They all have some charge or juice to them, and they all have some content to them. So sometimes we use the word inner to talk about those. But more technically, you could call them like the non-physical, the non-directly physical elements of our experience. So the mind can settle. This ideally should be a great relief to hear, because the vast part of our suffering, our pain, our distress, is embedded in the experience of the mind being not settled. Here I am, I move through my life, and what's happening is that outside of my conscious control, my attention, the quality of my consciousness that hooks on to different things, whether thoughts or feelings or conversations or other kinds of sensory contact, my attention, when it's untrained, when it's not able to rest in samadhi, jumps from one thing to the next all the time. I think about this, I think about that, I worry about this, I worry about that, I look at this, I look at that. It all is churning through. When I'm having a good time, I'm not really at rest because it's so kind of fun. When I'm having a terrible time, I'm not really at rest because I'm so trying to deal with it. And when I'm having neither a good time nor a terrible time, I just fog out because it's so habitual and dull, and I just try to, you know, like, eat some chocolate and make it across town without crashing the car, you know. But I'm still not at rest. I'm dull, but I'm not at rest. And then we come to meditation, and we're like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to concentrate. I'm going to settle in. And it's like a few breaths of, like, actually pretty nice experience. It's probably very nice for you, the first few moments. When you come, you probably wouldn't come if it wasn't so nice, unless you're that sort. I will do it. I hate it, but I will, you know. You laugh, but I know you're out there, right? Valiantly striving to accomplish something here. But what is this quality of mind? It's a quality that assembles or appears in our field when the conditions are ripe. So what would be the conditions for the attention to settle down and be just content, even, we might say, thrilled, to hang out with just what's happening here? So, like, let's assume for the sake of, you know, an experiment that you're enjoying what I'm saying right now. Let's even propose, if it were even possible, that you're so deeply enjoying what I'm saying right now that the thoughts of the rest of your life are gone. You're not worried about what's at home, you're not thinking about your work, you're not replaying that conversation you had with your special or non-special or challenging person. You're just like, whoa, I'm so into this thing. Yeah? We kind of like when that happens. It's really nice. I think it's partly why, you know, I get a little overwhelmed, I go to a movie like, you know, let's just say Black Panther recently. A big, loud, humongous, Dolby, massive, flying ships and beautiful people doing extraordinary things. And for a little while, I can't think about anything else when I'm in it. It's partly why we like it. Right? It gathers my attention. It does it by some degree of force. Right, it overwhelms my senses. The floor vibrates in there, you know. And I don't even go to the 3D. It's too much. But like, okay, it's so interesting that I'm not miserable about other things while I'm watching it. Why do you think it's making billions of dollars? Right. Besides that, it's the right thing right now, social justice wise, in a million ways, to have an awesome action movie full of beautiful Africans doing extraordinary things. But samadhi, then, is the ability of the mind to get so interested in something that everything else falls away. And now the instruction is, don't get so interested in a big entertainment from outside, but see if you can get really interested in these specific things that the mindfulness teaching says are helpful for liberation. And these things tend to be a few types of things. One is they are neutral to pleasurable, steady experiences that don't ruffle our system in and of themselves, like the breath. Ideally, if you're doing breath meditation, the breath is not a challenging or disturbing object for you. In other words, if you have a history with like asthma or drowning or something where the breath has been compromised, one thing from the kind of trauma direction would be don't meditate on the breath. Because there's actually going to be charge there, healing that has to happen. And that charge is going to inhibit samadhi. Choose an object that is neutral to pleasurable instead. So the mind, our attention, likes pleasure. Duh. I know you like pleasure. Even if you don't want to admit it. So here's a little model then. Right? If this quality of samadhi is what's happening when the mind gets to connect with something that it's interested in, and it's interested in things that are pleasurable, then tip number one is get more pleasure in your life. Yeah? And especially in the meditative sense, what can I orient to when I come into contact with myself in a contemplative way that first off is sweet, easeful? And then can I stabilize or settle in that before I go on to like wrestling with my ancient demons? If you come right out the gate and you start wrestling with your demons, you won't have the energy to do it. You'll lose. Bless you. And all I mean by lose is that you'll get lost in it. You go for a ride with the demon. It's okay. We need to get to know those folks. You know them very well, of course. It's habitual to go on a ride with them. How do you do otherwise? You have to learn to get interested in something else. And so here's something that I'll propose about the great hindrances, grasping and aversion and restlessness and dullness and doubt, is that we fall into them so often because we like them. And what I mean by that, and they're painful, so you don't think you like them. What I mean is your attention is more interested in what's happening when the hindrance is present than it is in your chosen object of meditation. The breath is boring, restlessness is interesting. It's busier, there's more happening. Right? The breath is boring, lust is really interesting. Why would I stop thinking about the object of lust? Yeah? It's like, oh, because I'm supposed to meditate. Like, don't think about them. Don't think about the beautiful person. Way more interesting. This is why samadhi needs, for instance, the view teachings and the ethics teachings to orient itself. Why would I choose to not think about the lust object, the person I find gorgeous and interesting? The only reason I might have is that I've actually been studying this path. And the path suggests that I look at my experience and I notice that if my mind stays with that samadhi, the samadhi on the attractive person, that it stays in a certain kind of spin. In other words, if I start doing that, I kind of do more of that. And there's actually no problem with that, especially if you're engaging with your object of lust ethically, like you marry them or you date them ethically or whatever you do. You know, you ask your permission, you ask their permission to think about them in that way, whatever you do. Right? If you're not a monastic, there's ways to do that. But you're not in samadhi with the breath. You're engaged with another object. So, samadhi happens when we actually get interested in stillness, calm, clarity, and the brightness of the mind at ease, more interested than we are in all of the hindrances and the content of the fantasies and the fears and the anxieties. You have to learn to not be compelled by the very real seeming fears and worries that your mind is coming up with, the things that upset you, the things that you fear. One way we can think about this that touches into what we could think of as nervous system work or trauma work is that we have these biologies, speaking of being human, that operate much the way many other animal biologies operate, which is we are fairly tender beings. You don't have a great exoskeleton or a vibranium outfit that will protect you from all impact, you know? Not to mention an awesome-looking suit, right? You don't have it. You are vulnerable, and you are not the absolute top of the food chain. Yeah? Try defending yourself from mosquitoes, you know, when camping, or from other cars on the freeway. May it be a safe life for you, but you know that you're not safe from danger in an absolute way. And so, being an animal, you hold that truth of being vulnerable in an animal way. And the animal way says that, and I'll switch now from kind of Buddhist language into kind of modern physiology language, you have a nervous system. The nervous system is what we call autonomic, meaning it happens deeper than conscious control, yeah, like all emotions. So you can't make yourself get startled. You cannot startle yourself. But when you get startled, right, something happens, boom, and your system, through no intention of your own, faster than you could do it, as a reflex, jolts awake, turns toward the source of the distress, and freezes. You know? You're walking through the woods, you crack a stick, and there's a deer nearby, and they lift their head from grazing, they turn toward you, and their ears go bing. So you do that, right? You get a little flash in the rear view mirror, and your whole system goes, whoosh, right? You hear a funny sound, you know, outside the window, and your system goes, hmm, you know? Or, you know, your sweetheart comes into the kitchen and says, babe, and you go, hmm? Perhaps. And what happens in that moment is that our attention turns toward something unpleasant. We get scared for a moment or concerned, and our attention turns toward that, the object of the disturbance, in order to determine whether it's a real threat. And very quickly, our system decides whether it's time to run, fight, or freeze. So fight, flight, and freeze. Can I defend myself? Not so well. Okay, can I run? Maybe, right? So here's kind of the order. If you can fight or flee, your system will mobilize to do so. And in a very ordinary biological way, blood flows to the limbs, digestion stops, heart rate and breath rate increase, focus increases. And narrows, right? You start ignoring pleasurable things around because it's important to do something right now. This is the sympathetic nervous system. It kicks in, fight and flight. If fight or flight are successful, like we get away, whatever it is, or our system determines that we are no longer under threat and we're healthy, parentheses, the sympathetic nervous system turns off, right? The parasympathetic kicks back in, blood flow returns to the central organs, digestion resumes, we kind of shake it off a little bit and look around and we're like, whew, that was startling. What's for dinner, right? That's when we're healthy. So healthy means it kicks on when needed and turns off when not needed. There's this third state called freeze. You kick into fight and flight, something's threatening or feels threatening, whether it is or isn't, by the way, doesn't matter actually, right? It's a state. You can get startled by something that is totally not a threat. Most things in your life are not a threat, right? So welcome to relative privilege. You wouldn't be sitting in a nice middle-class church listening to some dude talk about the mind if you didn't have some comfort in your life where you are not constantly under threat. So here you are, mostly not threatened. But I would totally bet that some of you in this room feel threatened right now. But for whatever reason. Some social anxiety is present. I don't really like being in crowds. I don't quite trust the teachers for any subtle subconscious reason. And there's some vigilance. Yeah, there's people here that are very much like me or not like me. I'm drawn to some people. I'm afraid of some people. The whole mix. I'm triggered by religion, but I force myself to come here because, you know, because the snacks are good, or whatever it is. Our system is processing threat so much of the time that's not actually real physical threat. And when that's happening a lot, we call it trauma. When it's happening a little bit, we call it ordinary life. But it's really just on a spectrum. Something in the past has taught your biology to perceive threat when there is not threat. And sometimes it was just like this. I was startled by something kind of bad when I was 2 or 6 or 15 or 25, and I never quite calmed. It just kind of stuck in my system as a little. And now I just call it anxiety. So the state of freeze is the one other to talk about. Fight and flight kicks on in response to threat, real or imagined. And if fight and flight are incapable of restoring safety, in other words, I can't get away, I can't fight back in whatever way, the sympathetic nervous system turns off. Not in the direction of calm, it turns off in the direction of freeze, collapse, overwhelm. Right? It plays dead. So when we can't get away, we dissociate. Right? We just kind of collapse and leave the body, which is a very good thing to do if you are being eaten by an animal in the wild. It hurts less. Freeze is analgesic. When you're shut down, things don't hurt as much. And I can tell you that I figured that out in a very direct way when I was about 12. And it was the best solution I came up with. So I stuck with it for a couple decades. You know, and I was a relatively privileged kid. In modern life, many of our deepest threats are inescapable. Yeah, climate change, capitalism, racism, sexism, the violence of modern globalized life, the destruction of families, the precarity or fragility in getting by in these cities that we live in. Fight and flight will not help you conquer those. You can't run. It was so easy when it was just like a tiger. Right? You make a lot of noise. You fight back. You run away. You climb a tree. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it didn't work. You know? So I hear. But a distinct threat. But, you know, nowadays you just read the news too much. And like, boom, overwhelm. Yeah. Because there's no escape. So I'm going to propose that samadhi, the settling and gathering of the mind in meditation, in any activity really, but specifically in formal meditation, is the result of learning how to shift my nervous system out of overwhelm and freeze and out of fight and flight, sympathetic engagement. That only when I learn how to do so to some degree, again, not in an absolute way, perhaps at first, but eventually in an absolute way, when I learn how to actually, we could say, deactivate from being startled, wounded, threatened, only then will my mind actually be willing to do what samadhi asks it to do. Right? Notice that the core gesture in meditation is to become still and to draw your attention inward. That's not a random, just like, thing to do. That's actually a thing to do that says, I am willing to trust deeply that my immediate environment is not threatening. I'm going to close my eyes. I trust you, people that I'm near, to close my eyes. I trust this room that I can close my eyes in it. And now, more deeply, I trust where I am in my life, such that worry and fear, which is really just, I'm startled about the future, I don't think it's going to be okay in whatever way, I'm going to worry about it. Oh, I have to answer that email. In some little way, my system is going, I don't feel safe yet until I figure out what to do about this tiny threat. Somebody wants to know where we're going for lunch tomorrow. I should choose a place. This minuscule threat is actually not just a distraction. I think we don't give our distractions enough credit. They're not just distractions, as if they were some random thing. They're not random at all. They are this habitual, deeply ingrained impulse that we have to pay attention to the sources of threat. And until we heal that habitual impulse, samadhi, I think, can't stabilize. We can have moments of deep stillness, but not in the stabilized way that samadhi asks of us and proposes is possible. This means that the pathway towards samadhi is a healing process, not just a willful or energetic or mental process. So the doorways to samadhi are pleasure, relaxation, mindfulness. It's really important that pleasure is one of the doorways. We don't perceive pleasure when we feel like we're under threat. Get more pleasure. Yeah, here I am sitting to meditate. And I'm like, okay, try to gather in my attention. Breath feels okay, it's kind of boring. And I might be like, okay, deep breath, savor the in-breath, pretend I'm savoring the in-breath. Okay, it's still kind of boring. Sigh, shake a little bit, look around. Whoa, here I am doing this thing. Stuff to do tomorrow, yeah, it's okay. There's some way that my pathway into samadhi is actually like I have this kind of quivering, like puppy or child sometimes. When my toddler freaks out sometimes, and he can't really organize himself, one of the things I'll do, and he'll ask, like, pick me up, I'll just pick him up and hold him. Walk around a little bit. He says, like, go over there. Like, go over there. Yeah. But really what I'm doing is I'm saying, like, this distress you're feeling, you can feel it, but I've got you. I'm just going to keep hanging out here with you. I got you. He's crying. He's just complaining about things. I'm like, yep. I want to say to him, like, my son, suffering is part of you. For some truth, but we'll get to that later on. He's two. Next year. But start him young. But what I really want to say to his nervous system is, the thing you're perceiving is it's okay. It's okay. It's painful and it's real, but it's okay. And if I can communicate that to him, then it settles. And I didn't even know that I'm doing it, but I walk around holding him because it's more pleasant than looking at him from across the room crying. So I do this with myself. I sit down to sit. I'm all over the place. And I just something bubbles up. I'm like, yeah, totally. In some way, the process is like, oh, I'm worried. Yeah. And I'm kind of scared. It's like, yeah. And when they come strongly, I have to just stay with them and be like, yeah, you're crying right now. Yeah, yeah, scared. And it settles. And this process is really like, you have to come through fight and flight and freeze, anger and fear and shutdown, by feeling them, by, in a sense, processing that impulse in the musculature, in the body. And as I do that, as I keep orienting, like, am I really safe right now? I am actually safe enough right now. I can do this. Those states settle. Right? As soon as I can perceive that kind of safety and ease, the system settles. And the more the system settles, comes out of those habitual states. There's actually very little that the mind needs to do. You come here to sit, you know the sitting instructions. If you don't know them, come twice and you know them, like, it's not complicated. If you weren't actually compelled, interested, drawn into worry, fear, anxiety, etc., what would your mind do? Very little, it turns out. Because the thinking process is mostly all about figuring that stuff out. Figuring out how to get safe, how to get some food, how to make some kids, whatever you want to do. You know? Once most of that is taken care of, not so much to think about. Here's another way of saying it. Once you're not interested in anything that's on television, it's not difficult to not watch. It's only a struggle to not watch when you're actually still interested in what's there. You can learn to be disinterested in anxiety and fear and shutdown thought. Not by dissociating, not by freezing. Freeze is tremendously active inside. Shut down outside, wild inside, right? I'm terrified and I can't escape. I shut down. That's not restful. Yeah. What is restful? Restful is like, oh, I trust my life enough to turn the TV off. I know the news enough for today. I know what I'm going to do tomorrow. That's why there's an inbox. I don't need to remember it. How extraordinary it is when we actually realize in our bodies that there's nothing else to do in this moment. And then samadhi has this extraordinary concentrated tranquility of our energies begins to assemble. And that's the beginning of samadhi. That's just the prerequisite. That's the healing process that gets you in the doorway. The doorway is called access. I would be remiss to give a talk on samadhi at Venerable Shaila's group without saying that traditionally samadhi is defined by a series of extraordinary concentration states known as jhana, in which this clarity and ease of the mind has assembled so fully that no effort at all is needed to rest in a profoundly easeful and luminous state. And then deepening, unfolding series of those states that get stiller and stiller, more and more radiant as they unfold. Some of you have experience in those states, and they're beautiful, beautiful, tremendously useful states of consciousness. But if you feel very, very far away from that at all, the doorway is this. When you feel really at ease, not because you're being entertained, but because you're actually done with being entertained by anything, and you have the little moment of just dropping into your life in this moment, wherever that happens, that is a hint toward what's possible. Being done with grasping in the external, resting into this released body. Nothing else to do. The heart and mind gather by themselves and begin a process of deepening. So do that. All right, so we need to take a moment to have a raffle drawing, apparently. So after the raffle, I'll stick around for a few minutes if you have questions and things like that. But I want to thank you for listening, and I want to bless your practice and offer that whatever blessing and force, traditionally called merit, arises as the result of our being here, and maybe what that means is just that it's a good thing to do this. And some part of you knows that, or else you wouldn't come. May the goodness of doing this, getting together to talk about wisdom teachings, practices, to practice together, to investigate, to engage with this ancient, gorgeous tradition that has made its way to California through a strange, long pathway. May we, as practitioners who are inheriting in some way, learning from this tradition as it's being expressed thousands of miles away from its origin, under a tree on the banks of the Niranjana River, 2,500 years ago, in a time when sages were living in the wilderness, seeking the deathless, that which was fully healed of fear. May that great lineage, through the long lines of karma arising here, may we engage with it so respectfully and deeply that it retains the transformative and liberative power that it began with. May the blessing of our practice shine forever. So, thank you.